to another week of Behind the Lens. I'm Debbie Elias, film critic, creator, and host of Behind the Lens, where we go behind the lens and below the line with those movers and shakers, those film and TV and streaming makers, the producers, directors, writers, actors, cinematographers, production designers, costume designers, film editors, sound editors, mixers, and designers, VFX gurus, composers, stuntmen and women, and so many more. And of course, yes, you know how much I love film and how much I like to talk about film and how much I like to talk in general. So it is a joy every week to keep giving you interviews and insight into the who, what, where, when, why, and how of movie making, with hopefully some interesting and entertaining conversations with the people making all of this stuff that you watch. Now, Dances with Films has come to a close in Hollywood the past couple weeks. You heard from some great filmmakers who had films, some of them world premieres at Dances with Films. Before that, we were talking about animation at Tribeca Film Festival. So let me just do a quick wrap on DWF for you. You know, I've got a few more interviews that are done that you'll be reading and or hearing about this coming week. And I still have a couple I'm trying to set up because I think the films are worthwhile and the filmmakers deserve to be able to talk about them. I definitely have some fave Dances with Films films that I hope we're going to see with distribution deals in the coming months. Notably, Yale from Jay Silverman, starring Kevin Dunn. I love that film so much. I just reminded George Pinocchio about it today. George needs to see this once it gets a distribution deal and talk to Kevin Dunn about it. Then there is the oh-so-fun documentary, Kabali and the Tiki Mug Obsession. It is hilarious. It's informative. Who knew so much about the tiki culture and tiki mug making? One of the most fun subjects in interviews ever with the filmmakers. And that's going to be up on the website within the next, 48 hours. Tender. A beautiful film. It's fun. It's weird. It's co-written and directed by Adam Hosel, and it stars Jess Weixler and Jesse Garcia. It is very cool. And David Koechner, he is a scene stealer. He is fantastic in the film. I mean, what would you do if you're broke and you suddenly find a brick of gold bullion in the wall of your house, but it's marked? So it's identifiable and traceable to whoever had it before. And that sets up all kinds of possibilities for you. But be on the lookout for Tender. I think it's still on the festival circuit. And that should definitely be getting a distribution deal quickly, as should Yale. Then, of course, there's a wonderful short film, Good Vibes Only, that I really had fun watching. Then there's The High Octane Bandit. There aren't enough words for the high octane in this film. And of course, I always have, must-see festival films. These are some of them. But I have to say, out of the assortment of films that I saw from Dances with Films this year, my top pick of documentaries is it's just so powerful. It is The Last Place on Earth, which spans a 9-year journey into the heart of Sumatra's Lucerne ecosystem. It's from writer-director David Booth Gardner, and we follow a group of wildlife activists as they risk everything to save one of Earth's last untouched wildernesses from the devastation of the illegal palm oil industry. They are all for the legal palm oil industry. It's the illegal palm oil industry that has resulted in deforestation, animal poaching, and because of what they do to peat swamps and burn them, that turns into pure carbon and affects global warming. When you think about animal poaching, most of us think about Africa. When you think deforestation, most of us think about the Amazon. But Sumatra is a complex convergence of everything. And Gardner lays it all out there for you in this documentary. So please keep your eye out for this one. It is a must-see festival film. It is a must-see film, period. When it gets out there in distribution. The world premiere was at DWF, so I anticipate maybe some more festivals or a savvy distributor snapping this up very quickly. But you do not want to miss The Last Place on Earth. It's that good. And it follows a journey. We meet a really adorable baby orangutan who's being held captive with a chain around his neck, and he's chained in a tiny crawl space between two buildings. And David, very kindly, we get to see years later what has happened to that little orangutan. And it will make your heart smile. But anyway, let's talk about today. Today, we're talking about the fantastic The Get Out, with co-writer and director Derek Bort. What a fun ride. Wow. I laughed. I was entertained. I love the story. I love the third act twist. The cast, led by Russell Crowe, is phenomenal. The production values are top-notch. Of course, how could they not be with Brendan Galvin as your DP and Mark Warner as your editor? I mean, Brendan is known for... he shot Plane, Unhinged, Rambo Last Blood, Escape Plan, and then some those beautiful films for Tarsem Singh, Mirror Mirror, and Immortals. Also Behind Enemy Lines, so Brendan can shoot. And Mark Warner is the editor. Mark has, I have personal, I hold Mark dear to my heart because of several films that he's cut over the years that I actually worked on early in my career, like Rocky III and Staying Alive, which I still love that film, people, and I will not apologize for that. But Mark has also done the beautiful Mao's Last Dancer, The Water Horse, Pacific Heights, that chilling, chilling film with Michael Keaton, Driving Miss Daisy. He's very eclectic. He and Brendan both. You get them as your DP and your editor, you get the best of both worlds happening. So, I was hooked. Hooked by this film. And the film's in limited release right now in select theaters. And it hits digital tomorrow, Tuesday the 30th, as well. So it'll be on demand and on digital, so you can sit at home and watch it. You can laugh, you can stop it, you can play it back. But it's a lot of fun. It is a fun ride. Now, The Get Out is directed by Derek Bort with screenplay by Derek and Daniel Forte, and it's based on the novel Strip by Thomas Perry. And in addition to Russell Crowe, the film stars Luke Evans, Teresa Palmer, and I gotta say, the scene-stealing duo of Nina Dobrev and Aaron Paul. These two, as you'll hear Derek and I talk about, they could have their own film of the characters that they play in The Get Out. Now, it's a really fun premise. Nightclub owner Manco, played by Russell Crowe, is on the verge of leaving his dangerous past behind for retirement with his girlfriend Sunny, who's played by Teresa Palmer. Suddenly, masked gunmen Carrie and Jeff, Nina and Aaron, rob him as he's going to the ATM at night to make a merchant deposit. they don't just do it once. They don't just do it twice. You get my drift here. And poor Manco suddenly finds himself squeezed by ruthless cartels, because that's money he's laundering, that he's depositing, that now isn't getting deposited. You know how that works. And then there's a mysterious newcomer, Joe Carver, who's played by Luke Evans, who arrives with an interest in buying Manco's business, money laundering and all, but at a severely reduced price from what Manco's willing to sell. So with danger closing in from all sides, poor Manco must navigate a deadly web of deception, power, and survival, where escape and retirement may no longer be an option. Now, I've long admired Derek's work in his films, going all the way back to The Joneses, and most recently his last outing with Russell Crowe, Unhinged, which if you haven't seen it, see it as fast as you can. Now, in this comprehensive look at the creative process behind The Get Out, from adaptation and casting to visual style, editing and music, and let's not forget humor, Derek showcases the collaborative efforts that contributed to the film's success. And something that I don't get a chance to do often enough, because so many filmmakers, they're writing their own scripts, their quote-unquote original material. But Derek and I, we get to dig into the adaptation process. And he talks about working with Russell, along with co-writer Daniel Forte, and explains that, what am I doing here? I'm reading my own notes and I can't even, and I'm confusing myself. But they took, he talks about taking creative liberties to better connect the ensemble of characters around the central figure of Manco. And what's really interesting are Derek's thoughts on the importance of weaving supporting characters like Joe Carver and Jeff and Carrie and Manco's assistant Spence into the narrative as they build to the explosive and unexpected climax, let me tell you. And of course, casting is king, and Derek's got a lot to say about Nina Dobrev and Aaron Paul as Carrie and Jeff. And as I said, they steal the show. Structurally, something that I love about this film is that although it's an ensemble, each character within the ensemble believes they are the main character, which adds a fun level of absurdity and depth to the overall story. And this, and I can't wait to hear from all of you as what you think of Russell Crowe as Manco, because I have never seen him like this. He plays Manco kind, gentle, morally complex, but he brings humanity and extreme likability to the role. He makes Manco endearing. We don't see this from Russell Crowe. So that in and of itself would be enough of a reason to see this film. But then you pile on everything else that's so good, and everything makes you is a reason to see this film. And of course, yes, we break down the film's visual style and the visual grammar on the whole with a discussion on Derek and Brandon Galvin opting for practical effects, especially in car chase sequences, which were shot almost entirely in camera to enhance realism and engagement. And you all know how much I love good stunts, especially car stunts, car chases, rollovers, jumps, and when they are done practically in camera. And Derek also talks about and explains his reasons for going with wider shots and longer takes, and treating Los Angeles as a character in the film, even though the film was shot in Australia. So now there is some visual effects involved in making certain parts of Australia look like LA, but if I didn't know the film was shot in Australia, I would have thought it was shot in downtown LA. It's that simple. Mark Warner's editing process, very collaborative and dynamic. And something that you don't hear a director talk about that often is an editor's objectivity helping to shape the film's pacing and narrative flow, and their willingness to push back on the director and challenge them and make tough decisions for the benefit of the story. And that's exactly what Mark does with Derek. So it's wonderful hearing him talk about this dynamic and collaboration. And of course, what's a film without a score? So we talk quite a bit about Brian Senti's score, and Brian has worked with Derek on other films, many films. And it's an interesting take on the score, I gotta tell you. But it's so beautifully done, and I love what Derek was looking for. And he explains all of that in this interview. So we talk fast, we pack in a ton of filmmaking goodness. So take a listen as director and co-writer Derek Bort talks about The Get Out. Hey, Derek, how are you?
Awesome. Thanks. Thanks for having me.
I am thrilled to be speaking with you. I just love your work so much, going all the way back to the Joneses. And you're pairing your last film that you did with Russell, Unhinged, blew my mind. I think I've watched that at least 6 or 7 times. And
thank
now,
you. I appreciate that.
And now with The Get Out, this is one fun ride. Wow. I laughed. I was entertained. I love the story. I love the twist. Your production values. I mean, you've got Brendan Galvin and Mark Warner as your DP and your editor. It's hard to top that combo. Just on every level, this is fantastic. Now, I know that you adapted this, you and Daniel adapted the script from Thomas Perry's book. How did it find its way to you?
One of our producers, Mark Fasano, sent, I'm not sure the exact order, but he sent Russell and I both the book, and we'd been looking for something to do together since Unhinged, and this one clicked. We both really, you know, saw the potential in it and decided that we wanted to try to move forward with it together.
Was this a tough adaptation from this book? You know,
It was a fun adaptation. I mean, you know, I think with, we took some liberties as you do normally. And, you know, some of the things that we were able to, we wanted to keep, you know, Manco's story was so key, so important here. And you know, we felt like there were some other characters that if they were woven a little more, into a little bit more connected orbits around Manco, we felt like it could really work perfectly. So we were able to have a lot of fun kind of, with the Joe Carver character and Jeff and Carrie and even Slosser trying to figure out a way to connect them all towards this inevitable explosive collision towards the end of the film. So it was challenging but fun at the same time.
Well, the fun part definitely comes through with all of these characters. And since you already brought them up, I've got to bring up the Jeff and Carrie. That is so over the top, balls to the wall, laugh out loud so hard you're going to be spitting milk or water out of your nose. And it all comes down to the performances by Aaron and Nina. How difficult was it casting the roles of Jeff and Carrie? Because if they didn't connect, that would have been really bad.
Yeah, I mean, you know, look, I love it. So first off, you know, they're fantastic. So thank you for saying that. I think that the characters are a lot of fun. I think that they almost, you know, could have their own film.
You know,
I think their storyline is so fun. And I think that was part of what pulled me towards this, what drew me towards this project, was that each one of these characters in this ensemble all kind of believe that they're the main character. And I think with these two, you know, it was really the absurdity of desperate people, you know, making increasingly irrational decisions while keeping the consequences very real is what was so fun with them. I mean, because they're both just in their own separate worlds, and yet they've been brought together here by this situation. Well, or I'd say Nina forced herself on Aaron's character, but you know, and it's just such a volatile mix of these two characters that it was just so much fun to really explore this with them.
I love that you say they could be their own film. They could. They are that hilarious. But you have it interwoven so well with Manco. That's one of the great things here. You get a character like Spence, who is so out there, and, you know, he could stand alone on his own in scenes if need be. And, of course, Joe Carver. But you have it, everything so intertwined, supporting Manco and his story. And I have to tell you, the character of Manco, Russell, is so essentially kind and sweet and nice in this role. It was like a breath of fresh air watching him as Manco. Sure, he's got a nightclub. Sure, we're laundering money. But he's such a gentleman, and he's so kind about the way he does things. Even when he gets robbed. It's like, oh.
Yeah, I think that was... I think that was the key with it, with this character was you know, he's a dangerous guy, and he's into some dark things, you know, in terms of the law. But morally, you know, he is a gentleman, and he's very likable. And Russell brought this humanity to this character who could have easily, you know, been a caricature. And I think that was, you know, part of what drew Russell and I to this project, was this character and you know, trying to find him together and you know, make this a reality.
He is so endearing. Manco is so endearing. And he doesn't want to see the bad in anybody, really. It's just, you know, they're misjudged, or something has happened. It's an accident. They didn't mean anything. And you really set the tone for this when we start off, and immediately he's in the car, and you make a big point. The camera moves in on that little blue pill he has stuck between his teeth. And it's like, you just know, all right, what is this guy doing? And then he pops an entire bottle of whatever it is. And then we go into the hilarious sex scene, I gotta tell you. And that just kicks off the rest of the film. That tells you he's so concerned. He wants, his girlfriend is much younger, and he thinks about these little things that you would not expect a quote-unquote criminal to do. And it just really, you're just along for the ride with Manco at that point. There's no turning back. And you just do. And what I love is also your visual grammar is that you keep so much of this full frame frontal. Brendan does a beautiful job with the lighting, with the lensing, the framing, so that we are right there. We are looking into Manco's eyes and seeing and understanding what's happening. And I really appreciate that, because then you counter that with these incredible car chases. Fantastic. Please tell me you did them practically in camera.
Well, look, first off, yeah, Brendan is amazing. I mean, we did Unhinged together, and I, you know, I've said numerous times about both Brendan and Freddie Woff, my production designer, that I wouldn't want to make a film without those guys. Just because they make me better at what I do, and they're also just great friends and amazing to be around through a, you know, sometimes a pretty stressful process. So, but the work speaks for itself with both of these guys. I think Brendan, you know, as you said, you know, he does such a masterful job of this, and whether it's character work or car chases. You know, we did a lot of car work together on Unhinged. And I would say in this film, the car chases were, I want to say maybe 95% practical. There may have been an insert or two that we had to get, but for the most part, and they may be 100% practical on this one. I know on Unhinged we had to have a little bit of stage work,
yeah.
But on this one, they're mostly practical. I'd rather shoot anything practical if possible, just because, you know, it may be a little more difficult to shoot, but the results I think are worth it.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, when you've got the scene where they're cutting in and out of the alleys, when Menko first goes after he gets robbed for the first time, and he takes off and going down alleys and all, it is shot so well, Derek, in terms of giving us an overview of what we're looking at. But then as the cars, especially Manco's car, cornering on rails around corners, heading down an alley, and then we cut out to a wider shot, longer lens, just absolutely so engaging, so incredible. And then, of course, when we have Aaron and Nina later in the film, in the third act, Jeff and Carrie are just, they can't believe what just happened. Third time a charm is not a charm when it comes to the Get Out. And that is an incredible, incredible car stunt. Absolutely fantastic there.
Oh, thanks. Yeah, that has a little bit of visual effects in it, but still, you know, 80% practical.
Yeah, it just, and even the aftermath of it, Nina's performance is so strong while she's in the car, and then after the aftermath of the accident, really amazing. Now, was the casting of this film difficult at all? Because this is an A-list cast all the way around, Derek.
I mean, I think casting's always difficult. I think that because, you know, especially with an ensemble, like you said, you know, this group of very accomplished actors, you know, they all have schedules. And when you're trying to make, you know, a tight schedule for a film work with getting these characters in and out, these actors in and out, I should say, you know, that part is very difficult. You know, it's like juggling a schedule because you have an opportunity to work with a Luke Evans or Teresa Palmer, or Aaron, Nina, you name it, or even Danny Zavato, who really was, I was very fortunate that he was able to make it work. I feel like you try to make the schedule work, you know, because it'll be worth it in the end, based on what you end up with on camera, and no one's going to really care about how difficult it was to you know, oh, the schedule was difficult to make and it put a little extra stress on this or that. And like, no one's going to even think about that. They're just going to look at the end result with all of these great performances.
It's hard to even say each one is equally good. There's not a weak link in the chain here, Derek, which always amazes me when I can say that about a film. A little bit ago, you brought up a very important element of your film, Freddie Woff's production design, and then his team, his art director, Daniela, and Anastasia, the set decorator. I got to tell you, the production design of the club, and especially Manco's office, that is fantastic. I love the saturated colors. It is just beautiful. And then with the lighting that's happening in the dance and bar at part of the club, just outstanding. How involved are you in a film like this with the production design? Because you've got a few standouts with your production design and your set decor, the club being one of them, also Rodriguez, his house with the artwork there, and even Manco's house. It's pretty stark, really, and clean. So I'm curious about your involvement in the design, in the visual design, before it even gets to Brendan.
I mean, I think that, you know, Freddie would definitely attest to the fact that I'm probably I'm very involved in these things, you know. I mean, I obviously trust him and his instincts, you know, and yet I definitely kind of stress over even the smallest details. So, you know, I'm thankful that I get to work with someone like Freddie and you know, his Daniela, you know, and the rest of the team were wonderful. But I do, you know, roll up my sleeves and get involved in all of that. And you know, if you like it, I you know, definitely give all the credit to Freddie. And you know, if there's a problem with it, I'll say it was a bad decision on my part. But because I can't, you know, sing these guys' praises enough. I'm fortunate to have the people that I get to work with that want to show up for me, you know.
And their work gives Brendan such a great canvas to work with in terms of lensing. I'm curious, how did you and Brendan go about developing the visual grammar for this one? Because it's very interesting, you stay away from ECUs. You give us some close-ups, but you really try and stay with your two shots in this one, even when we're seeing piles of money. So I'm curious about, but you go with faces. You're big on faces. So I'm curious about developing your visual grammar here.
Yeah, I mean, I think that we wanted to try to let some of these scenes play out in some longer takes and slightly wider shots, just based on, based on me being able to have the luxury of watching these amazingly talented actors collide on screen, you know, in the space that they're in. And I think that, you know, there's a physicality to these performances that, you know, demanded kind of shots that would place them in their environment and you know, be able to showcase that in a way. So it wasn't, I didn't want this to be super cutty kind of, you know, close-ups back and forth all the time. I felt like LA was a character. It's funny, I say this, you know, it's kind of ironic that we shot this in Australia, but LA is a character in the movie.
Yeah.
You know, the underbelly of LA, places that don't get seen that often in films, whether it's Koreatown or South Bay, you know, Manhattan Beach area, things like that. So, you know, I know we wanted to stay a little wider, and, you know, allow the physicality of these characters to kind of, you know, be appreciated a little more on screen. So thank you for noticing that.
Yeah, I really love that. And physicality is definitely the word for everybody in this film, right down to Teresa, who I know is very, very adept at physical roles. But even she, by the third act, even she gets to have her licks in there too. Now, you're working with Mark Warner as your editor. Mark is so good, so, so good as an editor. What was the editing process like for this one? Because it is so, it's fast-paced, but you also slow it down. There's some real rapier moves in here, so I'm curious about the editing process with Mark.
Well, I mean, I think the process, you know, it may be subtly different, you know, based on who you're working with. Mark just brings such a wealth of experience at the highest level.
Yeah.
That, you know, and he's opinionated, and he if he feels strongly about something, he definitely lets it be known, which I love. I mean, I the fact that you know, somebody with a more objective eye than I have is in the room, that also has the experience he has and talent he has, is important. I think that, you know, there are times when you've written something and you shoot it, you know, it's, you lose objectivity. You might get attached to a certain shot that just isn't moving the story forward as much as it could. And it's great to have Mark there to say, hey, we're not using this shot. Like, trust me. And then I say, fine, try it. Let's see what it looks like without it. And, you know, of course he was right. He shows me the scene without a shot and it works, you know, and I have the luxury also of just being able to be the dumbest guy in the room and surround myself with great people that, you know, that allow me to be better at what I do.
Just remember, you're the smartest guy in the room because you were smart enough to hire all these people and put them around you. Now, what were you looking for musically here? I mean, Brian Senti, I like the score here. It's very subtle. You really, you're so focused on these performances and the action and the story that's unfolding. You almost forget that there is score here. So I'm curious what you were looking for musically.
Yeah, I mean, look, Brian and I go pretty far back as well. We've done multiple films together. And, you know, he's such an artist and really finds the soul of different characters and their stories that you know, I think he did such a great job of, you know, Carrie's a hard character to find a theme for, you know,
yeah.
As well as, Manco, but then make them all work together in one sound, in one score is really, you know, he's really done a masterful job at creating a score that not only brands each character in a way, but also the film as a whole. But yet, you're right, how it doesn't, you're not always conscious of it. It's moving the story forward without drawing attention to itself. And I think Brian's so wonderful at doing that. And I think his score really is really special in this film.
Yeah, I really like this one and the motifs that each of the characters have. It could not have been easy to come up with a motif. It's hard enough to come up with one for Manco, but to come up with one for Luke's character of Joe Carver, because he's got, his role is so interesting, and yet Brian did it. Everybody's got their own little musical motif happening, and it all blends just perfectly. I know they're texting me, telling me we have to wrap. So, Derek, this has been so wonderful getting to talk to you about The Get Out. I thoroughly was entertained, enjoyed this film. I love the story. I love the characters. I love the look. It just makes me happy watching this film.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate hearing that.
Just wonderful. I can't wait. And since I love everything you do, I can't wait to see what you do next.
Well, I'll try to live up to expectations, I promise.
Well, and I hope you and Russell team up on something again too, because you guys are a great collaboration.
We shall see.
Derek, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
And that was Derek Bohr talking about The Get Out, which, as I said, it's in select theaters right now and starting tomorrow, available on digital and on demand. So check it out. Before I take leave of you, though, I've got a few things to mention. First and foremost, another film that is in theaters now that is a must-see, and that is Rod Lurie's Lucky Strike. I am beyond enamored with this film. I am in awe of what Rod pulled off. Set in December 1944 during the Battle of the Bulge, in World War II, for those of you that don't know your history, Lucky Strike stars Scott Eastwood and is one of the most powerful and emotionally immersive viewing experiences on the screen today. Lucky Strike derives its power not only from its World War II authenticity and remarkable technical and visual craftsmanship, but from experiencing the war through the first-person perspective of Captain Castle, an engineer who voluntarily enlisted and left his young family to join the fight against the Nazi regime. And Scott Eastwood plays Captain Castle. Now, World War II remains one of the few wars in history where good and evil are so clearly defined. A fact that lends itself powerfully to both filmmaking and storytelling. Production values are high, the cinematic structure is gorgeous, and Eastwood delivers the best performance of his career to date. Trust me when I say, do not miss Lucky Strike. My full review of Lucky Strike is up on the website. It's on Rotten Tomatoes. Yes, my reviews are on Rotten Tomatoes. I am a tomato, if you didn't know it, I'm a tomato meter approved critic and have been for quite some time. The review is out there. My interview with Rod will be up within the next couple of days. I wanted to give people a chance to see the film in theaters first, so that they know what Rod and I are talking about, with some of the particulars about this film. Now, one of my favorite subjects, Dutton Ranch, the Yellowstone spinoff. This Friday, July 3rd, is the season one finale of Dutton Ranch. Have you been watching? If not, time to binge and catch up, especially since it was finally announced that we're getting season two. Thank goodness, as this show just ups the ante in danger ever higher from week to week. And episode 7 just gave us some shocking insight into just how dirty Beulah and the Ten Petal Ranch is and what Rip and Beth are going to be up against. I'd say hold on to your hats, because the season finale this Friday could prove to be equal to a gunfight at the OK Corral. I'm chomping at the bit. And then I'll be dying waiting for season two. But you got time to binge before Friday's episode, people. And yes, Dutton Ranch, it's on Paramount Plus. So, if you haven't seen it, check it out. If you're a Yellowstone fan, I'm sure you've been watching. And of course, we're also on tenterhooks waiting for season two of Marshals, the other spinoff from Yellowstone, because we're all dying to find out. Poor Tate, Casey's son Tate, has been shepherded away to Texas by somebody who purported to be a friend, but who has ulterior motives. Going to Texas, Rip and Beth are in Texas. Who knows? Could we have a crossover somewhere? So there's a lot riding on Dutton Ranch and Marshalls right now. So now that is all the time we have today. Plenty of new reviews and interviews on the website for you at behindthelensonline.net. More coming this week. And plus, remember, all of our BTL radio shows, all 11 and a half years worth, are up on this website. So in case you've missed some, you can catch up, and you can, a lot of them, the first few years were video, at the radio station. So you can see them, you can listen, you know, catch up on everything. A lot of Oscar winners have been on the show live. A lot of General Hospital cast members were on the show live. It's proven in the past year and a half or so to pre-record the podcast, because so many people, schedules just aren't meshing to do a live show at 11 o'clock on Mondays anymore. So that way you get to hear from more people that you might normally not get to hear from by me doing the pre-recorded podcast. And so far, y'all seem to like it. So I'm still debating whether or not to do a show next Monday, July 6th. As that is still technically part of America's 250th extended birthday celebration that starts on July 4th. But it doesn't feel like a birthday celebration this year, though. Definitely not like it did in 1976 for the bicentennial. Of course, maybe that's because I was in Philly in 1976. And when it comes to the 4th of July, no one does up the red, white, and blue like Philly. But we'll see what happens for next Monday. But in any rate, until then, check out behindthelensonline.net. As I said, more new stuff will be coming out this week. So if you're bored over the holiday weekend, you'll have plenty to read or listen to. So until then, I'm Debbie Elias. This is Behind the Lens.